Yeah.
Yes, that's correct. Carl Adenau.
Who?
Carl Adenau, Addinall. He was a, came from England, got his doctorate degree, got his bachelor's and doctorate degree at Harvard. Died very recently at a very ripe old age of about 90. Was a good chemist. He did a lot of writing, and in a sense, is the one that modernized the Merck Index. He went to work for Merck, and as a matter of fact, he was very helpful in my getting a position at Merck. That came through two ways. One was Mr. Merck spoke to J.B. Kona, who recommended me for the position. And then Carl Adenau, who was my instructor in Chem 5, I've been kept in contact with him. Mm-hmm. He recommended me to his boss at the time, and he was also interested in the possibility of my coming to Merck.
At Harvard, in the Kohler Laboratory, did you all work together on, was there a lot of talk between the various graduate students helping each other out and learning techniques? And
well, in learning techniques, yes, but the problems were individual.
Right.
Occasionally, there'd be two people working, as I have here, working pretty much. For example, Potter and I worked on the same problem, but I was a postdoctorate at that time, mm-hmm. and he was still an undergraduate, or a graduate student. And but most everybody had an individual problem. The one thing that always kind of bothered me in those days was the fact that in Converse there were three floors. The bottom floor was Koenig, the second floor was Fees, and the third floor was Kohler. This is in Converse. And we rarely knew what was going on in the other groups unless you made it a point to. Now, I happen to have known pretty much what's going on in Fieser's group because I got to know Fieser. I did some checking of organic synthesis for him, and but you rarely knew what people in the Conus group was working on. This always bothered me, and I think this tends to be something that occurs in many institutions even today.
I think a lot of that stayed even in later, when I was there, the people were on different floors, and you occasionally would talk to other graduate students, but you didn't really know what was going on in the groups.
That's correct.
So when you first went to Harvard, you taught at the beginning when you were an Austin teaching fellow.
That's correct.
And did you also teach in the Chem 5 for?
Yes. I was instructor at that time, but still as an assistant to Kohler, mm-hmm. and carried out his research or worked on his problems.
That was later on. That was later on.
That's right. At the end of my, after I got my PhD degree.
Now you stayed on at Harvard after you got your
2 years. Yeah.
Jobs weren't available, or Kohler was looking after you, or what
right.
happened?
There just weren't any jobs at all. In those days, I thought I wanted to go into academia, and I wanted that very, very badly. And there just weren't any. Didn't have a chance to do a single interview. Didn't have a single interview or a single opportunity to apply for on the basis of an opening. So academia was out. Kohler tried to get me to interview for industry, and it only had one interview, and that was with DuPont. And that didn't work out very well. And but the only interview I had beyond that was with Merck. Randolph Major, who was then director of research, came to Harvard and spent some time with me, as well as spent some time with Kohler. That was very successful. that was the only offer I had, and I was so delighted to get that offer that time. But as I retrospect, it was a wonderful thing that happened that way. Mm-hmm. I've always been grateful for that.
Did you know, Carol, I don't want to leave that, but it just occurred to me, Blatt.
Yes, I knew him quite well.
Yeah. He was also a graduate student over to Rover Lab during that period.
No, he was already out when I got there.
I see.
He and Admiral were very close friends.
Uh-huh.
And that's when I first met them. I'm pretty sure Harold Blatt, he may have, my first year in the graduate school, he may have been there.
Okay.
But not when I was doing research. He was gone by that time, because I began to know all the Cola students. He worked for Cola.
Okay.
Now,
he had written the book with...
with Conant.
Conant earlier.
That was after my book.
After your book.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's right.
Okay.
When I went to Merck, the first revision, after I left Harvard, Conant went to Mr. Merck and asked if he can borrow me to do this.
I see.
So I did take 2 months off from Merck and worked with Conant on this and revising his textbook.
This is 1936 or?
I would guess about 38 or so.
Right.
38
or possibly. Came out
39. 39, yeah.
I was going to ask you...
That was a great experience working with Conant. That gave me an opportunity to learn and know him.
I was going to ask you, this is still on our Harvard, we're almost moving on to Merck, but we're still on Harvard a bit. Did Conant have a great deal of influence in the chemistry department once he became president, or did he move on to... did he have a bigger vision than and move on away from the chemistry department?
Yeah, he
moved
away. There's no question about it. I think he wanted to be sure that people didn't think that he was going to favor chemistry over our department. And he had a lot to learn. He was a very good president, no question about it. In my mind, he's a very good president. And he tried to learn everything he could about other departments. He still have an interest in chemistry from the point of view of some research. He and Kistiakowsky used to sit down and talk about problems of working. Matter of fact,
they had a project going.
They had a project going, the heats of hydrogenation.
You worked on that.
I worked on
that. Last problem.
That's right.
I remember.
That's correct. I was asked to make deuterized formaldehyde, half one deuterium and one hydrogen. And they wanted this for the study of hydrogenation too at the time, and they were using Raman spectrum at the time for, and I was asked to make this.
You also made some large ring compounds for them?
Large ring compounds with Cola.
Yes, but that was for that?
It was for the hydrogenation, that's correct.
Project.
Yeah,
right.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That was an exciting piece of research, I thought.
Mm-hmm. You want to say anything more about that?
I'm sorry?
You want to say anything more about that?
Well, not really, except that it was large-scale production. I used a lot of diazomethane. Made a lot of N-nitrosamine methylurea, or urethane, rather. And when people talk about the hazards of diazomethane and the carcinogenesis of the nitrosyl compound, I'm wondering if I'm still around. Why I'm still around.
Yes. Did you know how dangerous it was at the time?
No, I did not. As a matter of fact, I burnt myself with the nitrosyl methylurea pretty badly in my hand at one time. I didn't work in a hood, but I ran 12 feet of fast reaction.
Well, you better tell me about the explosion before I forget. There's the story that's handed down, and I've never heard the whole story.
Well, it used to be a time when, this is while I was at Merck, if I'd give a talk somewhere, I'd be invited by someone who knew me at Harvard, and asked me to give a talk to a section or to the school, the university. And always introduced me, didn't say a word about my chemistry, but always introduced me to the man that had this fire and hung out the window, third floor, and how they saved me. It was always something to laugh about, but they really knew who I was, except for that.
Except for the fire.
But what happened actually was that I was working with Kohler, as a matter of fact, as his private assistant, at a tiny lab right next to his.
Right, I know that lab.
You know that
yes,
lab
right.
is next to Bartlett's office.
Yes, right.
And there was a door that went into his lab, but it was closed at that time. What actually happened was that I picked up a bottle of benzene. It was a liter bottle of benzene. My hands are wet. It slipped out of my hand. Fell on the floor. And I turned around to go to pick up some rags to wipe it up. So I turned around and just about ready to apply rags when the fire broke out. I had a flame in the hood. And we used to, in those days, clean our apparatus by hot sulfuric acid baths.
We're still doing that 25 years later.
Oh, wait,
okay.
So I was heating up my sulfuric acid in the hood there, and I guess that's how the thing got started. It in such a position, the room filled with black smoke, soot very quickly. And the only thing I could do was to, it blocked my exit completely. I couldn't go through there, so I had to climb out the window. It's one of these windows, that casement type of window where you can just push the window open. Today you can't do that, everything's so air conditioned and what have you. I don't know how you'd get out in a real emergency today. But I hung out there, and right behind on the Malincrot, there's a courtyard there, if you recall.
Yes.
And then Malincrot was on the other side.
Right.
And there was a laboratory at that time, chemistry too was going on. That was Pisa's lab course.
Right.
And students saw me out there and they said, "Why is he hanging out the window?" There was Stutt going through the window too there. Well, Pisa got up there very quickly. He may not have been in the course, but he was up there very quickly trying to put out the fire. And they said, "Where's Max? Where's Max?" I could hear that. And I kept yelling, but they couldn't hear me. Finally, they got some ladders. I don't know how long I was there, but at least 5 minutes, I'm sure, that they got some ladders and rescued me. One of the things that bothered me about that whole thing was that the fact that I caused a fire, and we used up all the carbon dioxide extinguishers. And what I did was I knew someone that filled these extinguishers, and I insisted they come and get them, and I would pay for them to get them refilled. But the department wouldn't hear of that, of course. But I was really afraid that I was going to be chastised for this whole thing. I didn't appreciate what an accident meant. Well, that's the story of it.
Okay.
The fire, and they've forgotten it, I think, pretty much. I haven't heard people talk about the fire except that you were
Yeah, right. Well, you know, I was up there on the third floor, and people would talk about it and say, "Well, Max hung out that window." But I never heard the whole story. So, now it's on the record. Someplace in the New York Times article, there's a mention of a $1,500 award to do any kind of research that you wanted to do. Was that just your fellowship that you had
that's
the last
correct.
Couple of years?
Yeah, that's correct. Yes.
Can we move on to Merck now?
There are a couple more things that I okay. wanted to ask about
Harvard.
Let me
see if they have anything about Harvard that I want to mention.
Okay.
Well, there's another person at Tufts that I thought a great deal about. He taught physical chemistry. His name was Chadwell, C-H-A-D-W-E-L-L. He got his PhD at Harvard with Arthur Beckett Lamb.
Oh, yes.
And he was interested in the structure of water. And as I understand it, they still haven't established the structure of water completely yet. I met my wife at Tufts. I had her in the laboratory. She was a freshman. I was a senior. I had her in the freshman laboratory.
Was she a chemistry major as well?
No, she was a psychology major. No, she,
from Boston, the Boston area? Or?
Yes, she was in Boston area. She was born and brought up in Boston.
Did you consider any other graduate schools besides Harvard? Or,
No, that's the only one. Were there any others?
We were just talking about this morning. We were saying, gee, what an amazing group of people they had at Harvard during those years. And
Kohler, as you can tell from the picture that I have, the photograph, very small man, very small, delicate frame.
Mm-hmm. Was he a very religious man?
No. And there was nothing that indicated was religious. Pennsylvania Dutch. He was not religious.
And he was a bachelor?
He was a bachelor,
yes, that's correct.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that I was going to say something about, but maybe sooner or later you might ask me the question, namely the difference between chemistry in those days and the present.
Want to talk about that now?
Sure.
Okay.
Well, in those days, as you well know, that structure determination was quite different than it is today. It's so different that young people today just haven't the slightest idea how this was done, and yet all the important chemistry work that developed was done by methods which today are no longer useful because we have such better tools today. Spectroscopic methods, NMR and IR and mass spec, just changed the complexion of chemistry completely. On that. For a while I thought, gee, that this is taking a great deal out of, in the old days we depended so much on, when we ran a reaction, wanted to know what happened, on such things as carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen analysis, sulfur, zeisels, Zeyer-Witkoff determinations. And it's amazing how we got information and by deduction, logical application of thinking and deduction, we're able to establish a structure. And most of the time we were right on this, there's no question about it. We built up organic chemistry that way. It's really quite a challenge to devise methods. Ultimately, you came down to breaking the molecule up and the known fragments and trying to put them together again. And ultimately, you synthesize a compound that settled it once and for all. But as you know, it took a long time to get some of the complicated molecules such as the natural products. Morphine is a good example. How long it took to prove the structure beyond a reasonable doubt of the structure of morphine. Today, of course, we can do it very rapidly. And for a while I thought, gee, a lot of the pleasure has gone out of chemistry because that was really quite a challenge to be able to determine the structure of a compound. And it was necessary every time you ran a reaction practically, you had to, if you were studying reactions, you had to isolate the products and then try to establish their structure. Today it's so easy, and the most complicated structures are with NMR and IR and X-rays and all these tools, we can do this so quickly. And when I see what's being done today, the complicated molecules that are nature has given us, particularly by microbes, it's amazing we've never been able to establish the structure of, say, some of the, for example, just take the thing like it's come out very recently, ivermectin, which is a very complicated structure. I'm sure it's taken decades to be absolutely sure of its structure. And the whole thing was done in less than a month's time. And the proof is so rigid that you don't have to synthesize it anymore. You just know it's there. But this whole difference, I think, has moved chemistry so far ahead so quickly. It's really amazing what's happened and what you can do today.
When did you start moving into instrumentation at Merck? You probably had very few instruments at Harvard. Did you do any spectroscopy at all?
No, none whatsoever. Woodward came there. He started to move into spectroscopy. Fieser did some. UV. I don't think Conant even got very much into it.
I'm sure he did.
He did a lot of kinetics, but I don't think he did.
That's right.
Very much.
They did their kinetics by titration most of the time.
That's right. And Hagen, I think, was kind of late to that, really, on that.
I guess X-ray probably came in the 40s.
Yes, but I don't know if Harvard chemistry still, I'm not sure Harvard chemistry still has X-ray today.
I think Lipscomb finally brought it
that's
in,
right.
This
Lipscomb.
Was in
sure,
the 50s.
Sure, that's right. Well, at Merck, I think we were pretty quick to bring in all these tools. I think we had the second NMR piece of equipment in the country, next to DuPont, the commercial ones. DuPont got the first, and I think we got the second. The synthesis of cortisone, for example, which was done under my when I was head of research, we finally got the overall yield of that in production around over 30%. Now, it's no longer important, but in those days it was extremely important. And part of the reason was that we used IR to know what was going on in the mother liquors, that we didn't get material out, couldn't isolate any more material. And we learned a lot about the chemistry on that, and that was a great application. And when NMR came, that was even better for that matter, but IR was very helpful when we first got it and applied it. We had a physical chemist, Jeff Webb from Princeton. This is one of the things that Randolph Macon had vision to do, was to set up a physical chemistry department. And their job was to really introduce all tools of physical chemistry that could be useful.
When was this, Max?
In the early 35, 36
is when Jeff Webb was.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Matter of fact, there's a little story I'll tell you about Jeff Webb and his thinking as a physical chemist. The structure of penicillin, there were two structures that came down the pike. One was a beta-lactam, and the other was the azolactone structure. And the question is, which is it? And I took X-ray analysis to settle that point once and for all, and I guess there's also some IR work that was done by Shell on that program, which also indicated the correct structure. But really, the person that gets the greatest credit is Hodgkins of University of Cambridge, and for that and B12, she's got the Nobel Prize for, as you remember, using X-ray. Did I say in the mind meant X-ray? And Jeff Webb said that he was convinced the structure was the beta-lactam and not the oxazolone structure by a very simple thing. And that's a pK value of penicillin. In the beta-lactam, you have a strong acid. It's not tied up like an amino acid, it's glutathione. the oxazolone is tied up, you see. And he was convinced of that. He was right. Nobody paid any attention to it. And this was a very simple deduction he made, and it turned out he was right. I remember we had arguments about that. Homer Atkins, for example, was one of our consultants during those days. And he was so sure that the Ayers-Lactone structure was correct. So did a number of other people. Correct. Bob Woodland, on the other hand, felt differently. He felt the beta-lactam structure was correct. But that was on the basis of reactions.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting that a physical chemist would think of it in terms of not spectroscopy, but
pure
chemical basis. Again, can I go back to Harvard since my first interest is what was happening?
Well, I'm wondering a great deal.
That's okay, because all of it will be there. And I don't want to isolate it, but you did take Kohler's course, you took Kistikowski's course. Who were the other people on the faculty that you remember?
Well, of course, Louis Fieser.
Okay.
Forbes.
Okay.
I forgot his first name now. The Grand Master of photo. He was interested in photochemistry. Do you remember Forbes?
Oh, I know Forbes. Oh, sure. He was still wandering around there.
That's right, sure.
The little man was shuffling.
He was a
Bridgman?
Very nice person. I'm sorry?
Bridgman, was he still?
Bridgman was over in physics.
He was in the physics department, that's right. Yeah. High pressures.
I didn't know much about Forbes' research, and so I didn't realize he was a photochemist.
Yeah, and let's see now, who else? Well, that's Kisti, of course. I knew Kisti quite well.
When you said something about taking his physical chemistry course, you sort of smiled. I think.
Oh, I'm sorry. I said that it was Krauss. It wasn't Krauss. Krauss taught inorganic chemistry. He came to give us a course in organic chemistry. The person that I had before Kisti came the first semester was Sherrill of MIT.
Uh-huh.
This is a very famous, they had a textbook, as a matter of fact, something in Sherrill. It was all problems. Mm-hmm. The whole course was an advanced course in physical chemistry. Then Kisti came the second semester and took over the course, and that was a much better course than Sherrill's course.
Mm-hmm.
Sherrill's course was highly mathematical. It was all, as I say, a set of problems. You probably, if you mastered it, you probably came out better. Came out very well, but that's his name, Sherrill, I can't think of his first name. He was a student of Lewis, because he used to talk about Lewis a great deal.
Other people, other textbooks? I guess Jones was still there.
Jones was still there, that's right, yes. And I never took a course with Jones.
Who was chairman at WU?
Chairman was, I mentioned his name, he was a Tufts graduate, undergraduate. I mentioned his name a few minutes ago. Arthur Beckett Lamb.
He was chairman of that period, I see. Okay.
And he was also, as you know, editor of the General American Chemical
right.
Society.
Mm-hmm. What about any changes organic chemistry that were taking place during that period? Now, Kohler was really fairly advanced in his thinking, as far as I can tell.
That's right. He was an extremely good experimentalist, very able experimentalist. Worked in the laboratory himself, incidentally, quite a bit. And as I say, he was a very logical thinker and made some very valuable contributions in terms of 1,4 addition. particularly Grignard reagents too. And is there any from the Reformansky reaction?
He did that during much of his career.
That's
he
correct.
Started that research back at the turn of the century. Okay, you were still working on similar problems.
That's right. I worked first on alpha-bromo ketones, mm-hmm. which gave the same intermediates as with the addition to alpha-beta unsaturated ketones, the same type of an intermediate there. And that was kind of novel for Kohler. Mm-hmm. Worked out that reaction and worked out the relationship with the alpha-beta unsaturated ketones additions.
Okay.
The work, of course, which I enjoyed the most was the allene.
How did that happen to come about?
Well,
that was not his.
He had a student, Joe Walker, who was trying to make an allene and resolve it. He did some very interesting chemistry, but was never able to isolate or obtain an allene, which you felt sure was an allene. One of his